and get started. Today we have Erwin Wolter, who's a professor in development economics at Wageningen University in the Netherlands. And he has long-standing expertise working mainly on natural resource economics, but his recent research interests also include institutional economics, social capital, and also conflict and post-conflict societies. And a lot of his work involves experimental methods, particularly lab in the field experiments, but also RCTs. And today he's going to present some experimental evidence from rural Ethiopia on participatory resource management, early capture, and local livelihoods.
Great. I was just informed that my CV online is not available if you click on it, and that if you search around, you'll find something that is 5 years old. much of what you just said about is no longer quite up to date. I don't work on conflict anymore. I've stopped lab in the field altogether. I've moved into randomized controlled trials, and now I'm ready to do something else. Again, I'm not quite sure, but this is sort of the state of affairs. So sorry for not being up to date there. So this is, I'll be talking 45 minutes or so about some joint work with Goitom. I just heard that he's been here too. I was unaware of that. Otherwise, I would have perhaps picked a different paper. So this is based on a project that we have done together. I say we, I would say in fairness, it's mainly Goitom, especially in the field, to study the dynamics of participatory forest management. And we did an experiment to see whether we could improve the governance of these schemes. So let me first try to motivate the paper, then talk you through the experiment and the results, and then we can see what we think of this. So I think of this experiment as contributing, hopefully, to the literature on engaging with local communities, especially rural local communities in low-income countries. More and more efforts, I think, we observe in the international development agenda to reach out and to engage with these types of communities, be it in the context of community-driven development programs, where a lot of the design and the planning and the budgeting is also delegated to local communities, towards priority, devolving responsibilities for natural resource management to specific groups of users, but also cases where we try to somehow empower and train local users to monitor and try to discipline all sorts of service providers, mainly in the health and education sector. And the expected benefits of working with local beneficiaries of all these types of interventions is, I think, threefold. The idea that we can somehow overcome all sorts of incentive and information constraints. By engaging and reaching out to local communities, there's the idea that somehow we can create a sense of ownership and commitment, and thereby hopefully have more lasting or sustainable effects. And there is this idea that somehow if we set this up well and we reach out to specific social groups within these communities, then we may also be able to empower the poor. So we observe the past decades that tens of billions of dollars have been plowed into these types of projects, funding interventions, but also training local beneficiaries to assume these roles. However, the evidence of impact, I think, across the board has been fairly disappointing, right, across all these three types of projects that I mentioned here. So what Goitom and I looked at is essentially at the interface or the crossing of two approaches to community engagement. One, we will look at a participatory forest management where management and the extraction and all of that was delegated to local communities. And then within the context of such a government program where these responsibilities have been devolved, within that context we will look at specific groups and we will try to see to what extent ordinary group members are able to restrict elite capture by their leaders. So to what extent are these groups able to engage in some bottom-up monitoring? Participatory forest management, or the overall vehicle of our study, has become increasingly popular. According to one source that I've seen, up to one-third of all the forest in low-income countries is now under some sort of participatory forest management program. Some call it social forestry, some call it joint forestry. seems to be rather similar from my perspective. The underlying idea is that communities can draw management plans with some limitations, perhaps. They can then extract the timber, non-timber products. They can try to sell those on markets and share the revenues amongst each other, or they can consume these timber or non-timber products themselves. Within the groups that manage these plots of forest, we can typically observe, this is also what we observe in the context of Ethiopia, that local elites are somehow able to maneuver themselves into positions of leadership, where they make very strategic decisions. There's quite a bit of literature on joint or participatory forest management in Ethiopia. Over the past 10 years, I think at least 20 papers have come out, maybe more. Most of them focus on the sustainability of harvesting or the forest management side of things, and they conclude it has been across the board fairly successful. So forest degradation and deforestation rates have gone down quite a bit also in our study region. But the other side of the coin, or the other part of the objective, namely to improve the livelihoods of these poor group members, that part typically is much less successful. Progress there is much more contested. So what goes wrong? People start to speculate about this a little bit in the literature. Some people point to free riding by group members, because why would you engage in monitoring and enforcement and all these other things if everybody else does this for you and you can just share in the group benefits? The idea that somehow this system of regressive taxation, where you load management responsibilities on the shoulders of the poorest of the poor, may be inefficient given their high opportunity cost of time, right? Essentially, the responsibility for sustainably managing these forests now rests on the shoulders of the poorest. Capacity constraints amongst group leaders, local elites, have been identified by some, but I think the most important reason that has been stressed repeatedly, and also the main entry point for our intervention that I will talk about soon, is the idea of elite capture. Somehow that within these groups, the local elites have been able to maneuver into a position of authority, and that they're able to siphon off a large chunk of these rents, or maybe engage in illegal site selling, or do something else that allows them to more than proportionally benefit from these forest rents at the expense of their fellow group members. If we believe that this is the problem, then more intensive monitoring, scrutiny, might be the solution. Right? And this has given rise to some efforts in the literature to improve the monitoring. And there is a little debate going on now in the literature about the effectiveness of bottom-up monitoring. That means you just try to engage, in this particular context, group members, but it could also be the parents of children who go to school or clients of a local clinic, what have you, local beneficiaries, to engage them into the monitoring and try to discipline the service provider. In this particular case, can we somehow reach out to these local ordinary group members to hold their leaders accountable? And the evidence of these types of interventions is also not clear, at least. There's a very influential paper by Bjergman and Svensson that came out in the Quarterly Journal of Economics 10 years ago that argues that this is working excellently. Right? They argue that in the context of the health sector in Uganda, that by somehow providing information to local communities about the flow of resources that is made available to their local clinic, and then to benchmark the performance of that clinic to other clinics in the community, that really helped to make these local beneficiaries able to hold the health service providers accountable. And that resulted into huge gains in improvements in health outcomes. It reduced child mobility, it reduced under 5 child mortality. It had a bunch of very positive outcomes. Fine. But then the problem is that subsequent work in other sectors, but certainly also in the Uganda health sector, as for example demonstrated in this other paper by Waffler et al., demonstrated that it's not so evident that this is actually true. Right. So the Waffler et al. Paper also looks at the health sector, also looks at local clinics, but the sample is much wider and their measurement of health benefits is much more precise. And they find nothing. So they say, we don't know exactly what Bergman and Svensson did. We don't know whether these results, how they were obtained. But if you use our approach and you look at the same issue, then you find outcomes that are much less favorable. And we believe that bottom-up monitoring is not an effective way to improve health outcomes in Uganda. So this is the context against which we started to think about how should we hold our leaders accountable. So can we do this through working with local group members, or is this unlikely to be successful? And we, after some further speculation, we thought, well, there's a couple of boundary conditions that presumably will have to be satisfied in order for bottom-up monitoring to be successful. So within the group, people should be able to overcome collective action problems, obviously. They should know about to what extent is our local clinic or school or forest user group, how does it compare to other similar institutions nearby? Are our leaders doing a good job or a bad job compared to others? So there need to be some opportunity for benchmarking, which is also not always evident. Group leaders should be sufficiently empowered that they don't need to fear retaliation in real life. Right? So as I just mentioned, if village elites are also the leaders of your group, then maybe you think twice before holding them accountable, because all sorts of other bad things can happen to you in other spheres of life, perhaps, right? So that's important. And you should care about the issue enough, right? So you're unlikely to start monitoring and engaging in all sorts of behaviors if you don't really care about the outcome all that much. And I have something to say about that too. And at the end of the day, we will try to work with this list to make sense out of the outcomes that we find. So the objective of this study is to explore the effectiveness of bottom-up monitoring to curb elite capture, to improve the livelihoods of the group members, and to reduce inequality within the group relative to alternative governance modalities. Other ways to curb elite capture, most notably, have somebody from the ministry come down and crack the whip, right? Bottom-up monitoring. So within the context of our study area, the Oromia Forest and Wildlife Enterprise, that is the government agency charged with the responsibility for disciplining these groups and group leaders. So what happens if we reach out to these guys and ask them to become much more frequently involved in top-down monitoring? Or maybe we can even provide incentives for group leaders. And I'll be more precise about that later. So we have three different governance modalities, if you like, that we unleash on these forest user groups, and then we try to keep track of the outcomes. And the case we consider, I already mentioned this, it's about the decentralization of forest user rights in Ethiopia. Forest user groups were established nearly 30 years ago now. 30 years ago, we observed that for our sample of respondents, these forest-based benefits are really rather important. And in many ways, the scheme that we consider is similar to other participatory forest management schemes in other parts of the world, including India and Nepal. I've been reading up about some of the experience in Nepal, and it was almost like I was reading about our own case study. Same words, same problems, same issues. And as I started out saying, we implemented a randomized control trial, working together with the Oromia Forest and Wildlife Enterprise, so the government organization responsible for this particular activity, and they had doubts about the performance of their forest user groups, and they were seeking ways to improve it, and they had some open policy questions. And Goito, my co-author, he knew some of those guys, so this gave us an entry into their debate, and framing this as an opportunity to help them out, we engaged on this scientific project. So I'll say a few words about forest user groups. I'll explain the interventions that we implemented in a bit more detail, talk about how we identify the effects. It's simple, and I'll jump to the results. So prior to the introduction of the forest user group system in Ethiopia, so that is until the late 1990s, essentially the forests in Ethiopia were state-owned, but de facto, they were open access. People just went in and took what they wanted. And this resulted in very rapid forest degradation and also deforestation. So in our study region, so I'll be talking about a forest area 230 kilometers to the southeast of Addis Ababa. So here, in our study region, the forest shrunk from from under the 40,000 hectares to about a third of that within a period of less than 20 years. So something had to happen here, right? And this remaining forest area then, in collaboration with the Germans, was split up in little chunks, blocks, and were handed out to groups of local people who use the forest. Right? So a forest user group in the context of Ethiopia has 30 members on average, or I would say that on average 12 hectares per member. So these groups typically have access to 350 or 360 hectares of forest land. The idea is that when they start up, they form a group, membership is voluntary, they signal to the OFWE that they want to do this. Somebody from the government comes down, proposes a sample bylaw that says, okay, this is how it can be done. This is not how it has to be done, but we recommend that you form a general assembly where all the members become all the group members become a member of the general assembly. You meet once or twice a year. You talk about areas that are important for everybody. Then you have an executive committee of five. So that's the leader, the vice leader, and one guy or girl, typically a guy, keeping charge of the finances, the cashier, and there's two other people in that group too. And potentially, in some groups, there are other committees, technical committees or monitoring committees. That's sort of the structure, and then they came with management recommendations about allowable cut, about replenishment, replanting, these types of things. And all of this was discussed at the local level. Groups could then propose changes, amendments to the sample bylaw. And at the end, the final bylaw for that group, it varies from group to group, was then agreed, typically approved by the government, and then the group started. Groups, as I mentioned before, harvest timber and non-timber resources. They pay an annual rent to the government. And as long as they pay the rent, and as long as the harvest level that they choose does not exceed the annual allowable cut that has been set by the government by more than 10%, then the license to work the forest is extended by another year, in principle for perpetuity, right? For an infinite time horizon. As long as you pay rent and don't over-harvest, then you're good. And now, essentially, all that residual forest is now managed in our study region by 132 forest user groups spread out across 13 cabelas, villages, and they have 3,600 members. And as is clear, I mean, the deforestation more or less stopped, but it's not so evident to what extent the people in this area have actually benefited from the creation of these groups. So what we did, and I say we, I mean Gordon, traveled together with somebody from the Oromia Forest and Wildlife Enterprise, from group to group, and explained that the Oromia Forest and Wildlife Enterprise was considering to change the management regime, and that they were exploring options, and that for this group this had particular implications. So we divided our sample into four treatment arms, or four experimental arms. As I mentioned before, the top-down monitoring by the people from the government, the bottom-up monitoring by a new committee of elected group members. So some of these forest user groups, in their bylaw, already had a monitoring committee. And sometimes in the monitoring committee, this was the typical outcome. When you look at the composition of those monitoring committees, it's the same guys again, right? It's to some extent the elite watching itself. It's the one guy is the group leader, and his brother is in the monitoring committee. Most of the committees, most of the group members that we talked to, said, "Well, we don't actually hear anything from our monitoring committee," and I presume this got something to do with the composition of these committees, which is not based on anonymous voting. This is really, to some extent, also the result of people shouldering their way into this. So what we did here is we had anonymous elections where people could be voted into this position, and then these people had a specific mandate and also obligations to report back to the community. And then we had a reward. So here we had a system that is essentially the same as the top one, the government comes to town repeatedly and checks your books and checks your forests and talks to people about what's going on. But rather than to punish the bad guys, and I'll be more explicit about this later, here they reward the good guys. So the scrutiny is the same, but the outcomes are different. And then there is a bunch of villages that are in a control arm where it is essentially business as usual. So here's a bit more information about the treatments that we thought of these groups. And these were developed to some extent in consultation with the Oromia Forest and Wildlife Enterprise, because it doesn't make a lot of sense to do an experiment and to test interventions that cannot be replicated or scaled. So initially we came up with much more ambitious types of interventions, but none of this really would fly on a larger scale. So we were a little bit trimmed down in our ambitions, and this is what they thought would potentially be scalable. I'm not sure about this because it's still a lot of extra effort, but we'll see what you think about this. So the top-down monitoring, we randomly allocated groups to bins, right? So 33 of them or so went into the external monitoring bin. We invited representatives of these groups to a session where we explained that there would be this change, that there would be new monitoring, and what this would mean for their group. People were sent back to their group to explain the change, and then 1 or 2 weeks later, the OFWE officials actually visited the forest user group, explained the rules of the game, and started with their inspections. What they did is they checked the books, they checked the forest, and they talked to people. They had scorecards. To some extent, they used similar approaches as have been used in the health and education sector, right? So you tick boxes and you see whether things are done properly or not. Are the punishments that are associated with a violation of rules, is that consistent with the bylaw? All the sales, are they worked out in the books? Are there receipts? I mean, all that sort of stuff. And then after representatives of the government came to this group twice, 6 months later, there was a General Assembly meeting where the OFWE people explained their findings and said, okay, this is what we found, this is what we observe, this is how your group compares to other groups in this district that we have also looked at, and is there anything that we are missing? Are we correct? So there was a discussion about this that could lead to some changes in the findings, right? So this was taken on board, and then it was sent up to higher level of government. So the local OFWE people sent it up to somewhere higher in the hierarchy, where somebody decided to either express appreciation for the leader for doing a good job, warning the leader, or actually sacking him, sending him or her off for failing to do a job. And after the replacement, I mean, that essentially meant that there would be a new election process where we asked for volunteers, so group members volunteering for this position, and then there was an anonymous election process afterwards, where one guy was elected as the new group leader. That's top-down monitoring. Internal monitoring is, yes?
What informs the assessment's gap?
Sorry? What informs
what,
that?
What informs the assessment for the external monitoring?
I'm sorry, I didn't. What informs?
What informs the assessment? So they.
Assessment? What do you
so
mean?
So they go to them, they. What do you call it? Visit them, they collect data, they speak to the.
Yeah, exactly.
And they go back to them after 6 months.
Yes, and they do the same again. So they have two rounds of inspection, talking to people, going to the forest and looking at the books, essentially.
Yeah.
And then after two waves of data collection, then there is that General Assembly where they just provide feedback and they report their findings and they open up and they try to find out whether what they documented is correct or not. And to some extent, the other members know, right? Because to be in a forest user group means to be involved in monitoring and to keep track of what happens in your forest. On average, members of a forest user group spend 90 days per year patrolling the forest. So they know what's going on in the forest, where stands of trees have mysteriously disappeared or not, right? And then they know whether it appears in the books or not. That is the idea. Here we try to leverage that more directly, right? Because so here the idea was, again, representatives of the groups are brought into a meeting, they're invited or they're explained the whole overarching idea, they're sent back to the group. A couple of weeks later, representatives of the government come to the village, they explain this again, and they say, we need volunteers for a monitoring committee that will hold, that will inspect the books, that will walk the forest, and that will talk to others and prepare a report to be shared during the next General Assembly meeting. So then they organized an anonymous election where people could anonymously vote for specific group members to take on that responsibility. And the people who were selected were then trained first and provided with material second in order to be able to do something comparable to what the government people did. So they received some training, they received information or guidelines and monitoring, some material support. They were told which key indicators to consider and how to discuss this also with others in their group. Then, again, a couple of months later at the General Assembly, the monitoring committee provided feedback to the rest of the group, talked about what they found. At this meeting, the Oromia Forest and Wildlife Enterprise people were also present, and they made an effort to sort of, again, benchmark these results. Okay, this is what happened in this group, and this is how it compares to other groups. And then after this, there was an election where group members could anonymously decide on one of three outcomes, again, appreciation, warning, or replacement. Anonymous voting. So here two leaders were sent home, and then they were replaced by others. And the whole idea, again, of anonymous voting, of course, is to protect individual members from retaliation by the elite later on. And the reward system is the same as this, except that when, after the General Assembly and the feedback and all that, when the local officers reported back to higher levels in the hierarchy, the guys higher up in the hierarchy did not decide about sending people away or warning them. They picked the three best performing leaders, and these were given a solar panel worth $60. So this is a reward for doing well when exposed to scrutiny as opposed to being punished. So this is sort of how it all breaks down. This is a timeline. So we started with the baseline data collection in the spring of 2017. The intervention started a month later. This is important, I guess. The General Assembly, including the sending away, the replacing of the leaders, etc., all of that took place in December, January, and the data that I will be talking about are collected another 10 months later. Right, so there's a big delay after this General Assembly and this, and let me be completely upfront about this. This doesn't matter for the bottom-up monitoring or for the top-down monitoring, because these activities were still going on. But it does matter for the reward or for the incentive treatment, because what we did is we gave these solar panels in January 2018 without promising that there would be more channels, panels in the future, right? So if people only respond to the promise of a future reward, then you should not expect this treatment to make much sense. To the effect, perhaps, that leaders change their behavior here in order to qualify for the solar panel, and maybe that affected the expectations or of the group members, and say, well, we want more of this. We don't accept it to go back to the old ways. This is what we want. Maybe it could have an effect here, but we don't know. And now, in hindsight, I think we made a mistake not to promise a second reward here. So, I mean, take these results with a pinch of salt, when at least when talking about the reward intervention. I've talked about this paper before with some people, and they said just take that out of the story, take it out of the paper. Don't bring up the word reward altogether, because this is where you obviously failed. And maybe it's right, but I think it's not quite transparent to take out the bits that somehow didn't work out as planned. So here it is. Yes.
For the reward group, would they also have an opportunity to elect again the leader or change the leader or something?
Well, sending away leaders was not part of the intervention, but it could happen, as it could happen in the control group, right? So there is a normal process of churning where people come and go, and the way they are replaced. So as will become clear, in the control group, but also in the reward group, this is really super low. This happens rarely, but it can happen, and it did happen. So we had very little attrition. I mean, this is no surprise, because these groups are there to stay, and households are represented in these groups. New members are not admitted. If I would die, if I'm in a group and I die, or I migrate to another area, then I will be replaced by my son or my brother, right? So somebody within the household will be appointed to replace me. So there's very little attrition. We couldn't find a few people, but they should still be there. We found, I shouldn't say perfect balance, but really a good balance. So we control for, we do a diff and diff, essentially. So we control for any pre-existing differences. When we look at the data, we also find what we expected, that the elites really dominate the leadership of these forest user groups, right? So these are they're religious leaders, they have formal positions of authority, they're also richer, they are, in terms of having a higher income, they are better educated, but also, and this is really a very striking difference, in terms of assets, they have much more, I would say 4 or 5 times as much as the others on average. So we do find that the people who represent the group are really not a representative subsample. So we adopt some standard approaches, the Ethiopian Rural Household Survey, to measure income, but also consumption, and also forest benefits, so the income that you get from forest-based resources. And then in addition to all of this, we also, at end line, not at the baseline, at the end line, we ask members about how they appreciate their leadership, whether they feel represented, whether they think the group works well, whether they participate themselves in these meetings, whether other people participate in the meetings, whether people respect the rules, and all that, right? So something about the functioning of the group, and especially the role of the leadership ship they're in. And then we estimate this diff and diff model, where these are our dependent variables, so that's income, consumption, and these other things. We have the treatment arms. Here this just amounts to a balance test, right? Here we have the time wave, the second wave post-intervention, so these are the December 2080 data, and we are especially interested, of course, in this interaction term, right? That from the diff and diff perspective, this is where, if anything, there should be something to report, and I will essentially report especially these. Let me jump to the results, because they are fairly strong, I think, and surprising. So what we find here, I mean, this is just replicating indeed that there is some balance. I mean, there is a time trend for this time period between the baseline and the end line. The household or the income of our respondents increased, and the distribution of the benefits within these groups became more equal. So we have an inequality outcome here. That's just a Gini coefficient that we computed for the 30 group members. So we see that across time, yes, there is all of this, but the more important thing, of course, is the impact of the interventions, and here I have the three interaction terms, and I think what is evident straight away is that the reward doesn't do anything, either because rewards are unimportant or because we messed up the design, as I just explained. All of that's fine. This is the bottom-up monitoring result, and as you see here, they are absent. They're not nearly significant, but the top-down monitoring, external monitoring, times the second time back, really gives us very strong results in terms of forest-based income, in terms of overall income, and in terms of consumption levels. And we also find that the distribution of benefits within these groups is even more equal now than it already was. And these are the consumption, income, and forest benefit levels of the non-leaders, right? So we in every group we have a random sample of 12 ordinary group members, and we see their income shoots up and their consumption increases as well. And this is 0.3 standard deviations. That's a sizable effect size within such a short notice, right? Some of these benefits, I asked Goitom, I said, how can it be that people, in terms of standard deviation changes, this is the largest, as you would expect, right? 0.3. Here, this absolute gain is larger in terms of the standard deviation gain. This is only 0.2, and this is also 0.2. I asked him, how can this increase by more than this? And Goitom's answer was, well, to some extent, this reflects that part of these forest benefits are used to buy fertilizer and other inputs that also increase agricultural income. Right? So to some extent, these early income gains are leveraged and translate into further income gains somewhere else. That's the story that Goitom told me. Top-down, yes. Bottom-up, no. Rewards, no. Now, of course, we want to know, okay, why is this? What's going on here? Let me show you the results of an OLS regression. This is just based on the endline data, where we look at the survey questions that we ask the respondents. So how happy are you with the leadership? Do you think the leader is responsive? Do you think he is... If you have complaints, can you go... So these are essentially... These are index numbers based on 10 underlying questions about to what extent people feel represented, to what extent they can complain, to what extent they are taken seriously, etc. And here again, you'll see that the internal and the reward essentially have nothing, right? Not in terms of how the leader behave, not in the sense of how the group as a whole functions, including their own participation and influence. But again, we document that in an external monitoring setting, where the district forestry department comes to the village and cracks the whip, we'll find that people are much more happy about the way the leader behaves and the executive committee more broadly. They become more active themselves, and other members also behave more inclusive or in line with the rules. Income goes up. This does not come at the expense of extra cutting, right? This is something that I also suspected. I mean, that cannot really be, because the OFWE keeps track of aggregate harvesting anyway, and if you harvest too much, 10% more than the annual allowable cut, then you lose your permit, right? And then the group will be essentially lose the access rights to that forest. So the margins for increasing harvesting are super small. Here, people are asked about the subjective appreciation of the forest condition. That also indicates that the forest is not degrading. We have access to satellite data, and we have access to forest experts who walk transects in all these forests to keep track of illegal harvesting, charcoal burning, wood fuel wood collection, etc. All these data we have, but we have not analyzed that. But based on the data that I do have, I don't think there is any evidence to support that the forest is being degraded. So let's ask two questions. First, why does top-down monitoring increase economic outcomes, including also and also the appreciation of the leaders, right? And we think that there's two potential mechanisms there. One is that the bad leaders are being sent off and they're replaced by good ones, possibly, right? The selection effect. Or the incumbents realize that they're being watched and they behave more, they behave better, right? They now have an incentive to behave more in line with the bylaw. We do indeed observe that many of the leaders were sacked by the government. So almost a third, well, a little bit less, but 9 leaders out of 33 were sent home. More than 27% of the leaders were replaced. Whereas in the control group, it's only 1 out of 34. Right? So this is really a huge increase of replacing the bad ones and getting the other ones in. So that seems to support the selection story. But, as you might expect, it's not so obvious that... I think it's true that the bad leaders have been replaced by better ones than before. But the new people who come in, they are still liked less than the old leaders who stayed, and they're also liked less on average than the leaders in the control group. Right? Existing leaders are valued higher than the new ones. What that means, and it's consistent with the paper by Grossman and Hendon, if you promise additional scrutiny, if you tell somebody, I have a position here for a leader, but we will watch over your shoulder and we will make sure that you cannot behave dishonestly, there's no rents for you to extract or anything like that, then the attractiveness of that leadership position really goes down, right? That makes sense. And Grossman and Hendon say, we predict that in this context, lower qualified people will volunteer for the job because the highly qualified people, their opportunity cost is now too high. That is exactly what we find. So we find that the new leaders who replace the ones that are sent home have less experience in business, less experience in forest management, and they're lower educated across the board. So we don't get the top guys in, we get pretty poor people in, but presumably less mean and selfish than the ones they send out. The bigger effect we find is with the existing leaders. If you do a propensity score matching, we'll find that these guys, so the 34 minus 9, those 25, they behave much better. They're liked much better than their peers in the control group. So that disciplining effect seems to matter a lot. Why does bottom-up monitoring fail? Right? And we had those four boundary conditions that I mentioned earlier. I mean, social information, empowerment, collective action, etc. This study was designed to deal with much of that, right? So we believe that the way we set this up, collective actions were solved, or at least attenuated, because we had these election processes for monitoring committees, so everybody knew what their mandate was. The OFW people provided relevant benchmarking information during the General Assembly meeting. There was anonymous voting, which really meant that people did not have to fear individual retaliation by the leaders after. So we also indeed find that more than 18% of the leaders in this arm were replaced. Right? So when voting is anonymous and people have information, they're quite willing to send their leader packing. But across the board, this did not, on average, result in improved outcomes. On average, monitoring committee, and that is because it seemed that fourth condition, namely, people should care enough about the problem at stake to devote their time and attention to this, it seems like this fourth condition is not satisfied. When we look at the effort that monitoring committee members put into actual monitoring, we find it is not more than ordinary members in their group. It is also not more than ordinary members in the control group. So we don't find that the monitoring committee does a good job in trying to retrieve any information. So we believe that this lack of interest story explains why, on average, these monitoring committees composed by group members don't work. But there may be some pre-existing heterogeneity here that we can exploit to get a better handle on this. So what we did is we cut the sample in two. So we now distinguish between groups that at baseline were relying on the forest for more than 30% of their income, or we did a median split. And we have groups that did not depend on forest-based income to the same extent, right? So here we have the forest-dependent groups for whom the forest is really important. And here we have non-forest dependent groups where the members may be considering forest-based benefits as a nice extra source of income, right? Because they're really maize farmers, or they're really into goats or other animals, and this is just an extra. Now, what we find, first of all, if we make this sample split at baseline, we find that in these groups, on average, people monitor much more than here, right? There's not a whole lot of monitoring going on here. In this context, if you send in the guy to crack the whip, he's going to have a huge impact, right? That's what we find here. The people who don't depend on the forest, who don't monitor so much, if you send in the government to do it for them, it has a big impact. It will improve everybody's income, and it will make the income much more equally distributed. However, when we look at the forest-dependent groups, where the group members themselves already engage in monitoring, then sending in the government has much less of an effect, right? It's not essentially, they will be duplicating what the people themselves are already doing. But leveraging the effort of these group members by giving them some better tools to do their job, to give them a training, to give them the scorecard, to give them an opportunity to provide feedback to the others and to have the anonymous voting, then suddenly has a big impact, right? So here we find that bottom-up monitoring can be almost equally effective as the, depending on the cutoff that you use, as the top-down monitoring. It only works in a subsample of groups, namely in that subsample where people care about forest-based income a lot. Which then brings me to my final slide. So this is the question that we started off with, right? How should we engage with these local communities and overall in development initiatives, in our particular case in participatory forest management, given this consistent evidence that we have of elite capture across different contexts, right? So we have three governance modalities that aim to reduce elite capture and to promote a more equal flow of benefits to group members. So what we find on average is that top-down monitoring has large positive impacts. And this is, of course, consistent with the Olkin et al. Paper that some of you may have seen in the Journal of Political Economy in 2007. He looks at infrastructure development in Indonesia. He too finds that sending somebody from a monitoring firm down to the village to check the books and talk to the chief and collect some gossip about what's going on works. It's exactly what we find on average. Bottom-up monitoring has on average no impact. So this really flies in the face of those findings by Bjerkman and Svensson. But if we then zoom in on that subsample of forest user groups that's really dependent on forest-based resources for their income, so for more than 30%, then we find that bottom-up monitoring does work. Right? So for that subsample, our findings are consistent with Bjerkman and Svensson. And now going back to that earlier discussion about Uganda health sector with Bjerkman and Svensson on the one hand arguing that bottom-up monitoring worked, and then that follow-up study, larger, better, more precise, by Raffler et al., that says, well, we look at the same sector in the same country, we don't find anything, what's going on here? We think the earlier analysis is purely misguided. A key difference between the early and the late paper is that the early paper is based on health data and interventions in 2004, and that follow-up paper was based on data collected in 2014-2015. When you look at under 5 mortality in 2004, Uganda was really an outlier. 170 per 1,000 live births died under 5. This was really a top priority. This was on the mind of the parents, right? So in terms of salience, child morbidity and mortality was super important at the onset of this century. 10 years later, when Raffler et al. Collected their data, or when the data that they used were collected, you can see that this under 5 mortality rate halved, or more than half. Now, 59 per 1,000, that's still a lot to Finland standards, I'm sure, but this is much more in line with African outcomes in general, right? So it seems that under 5 mortality has somehow been changed from a top priority for parents to something else that is also important, but maybe not the most important thing, given all the other problems that you have. So one way to reconcile the Bjerkman and Svensson and the Raffler et al. Paper is that somehow the salience of under 5 mortality has changed through the years. And that is exactly consistent with what we find, right? The salience of the topic matters. If people really focus on the forest for their income, they work hard to get it, and the monitoring works. In any other context, no. People have other things on their mind that occupy them more intensively. And then relegating all sorts of responsibilities on the shoulders of these people is not going to have a lot of impact. Our reward treatment did not work, but okay, we talked about that. And I think this is something that Goitom and I are now talking about, and we haven't made any progress yet, but really what we would like to do is to think about a new design that one way or the other combines the top-down and the bottom-up, right? Because if you want to have a robust approach, and what we find now is that if you move across the landscape in this part of Ethiopia, in half of the groups, approach A works, in half of the group, approach B works, And in none of the groups, both approaches work. So if you want to have an impact, you probably need to combine the two. And how to do that, that is something that, that we're not quite sure of. But the Oromia Forest and Wildlife Enterprise is willing to spend more time with us to explore this in the future. So let me keep it at this. I'm sorry if I took a few minutes more.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Yeah.
Three quick questions. One is that the spillover effect, I mean, these villages are quite not, the treatment arms, not close to each other, there's a journey going on between villages.
This is tricky, because essentially what we did is we have different treatments. It's not quite a block design. I think with hindsight, that's what we should have done, but we don't. But it worked out almost as if we used the block design, where we have the four different treatment arms within a village. So remember, we have 132 groups, and we have only 13 villages. So on average, 10 groups per village. And what we find in almost all the villages, I think in 11 out of 13, that all four treatment arms are represented. So to the extent that forest user groups come together and meet and mingle in other contexts than this, and they learn about the outcomes in the other groups, I mean, this could cause spillover effects. I agree. I don't know. You could perhaps, the alternative would be to do this at the village level, right? But then the unit of randomization would be 13, which means that this could never work. But now, indeed, through the potential spillover effects, I think we may be introducing some bias here. People may have wondered what's going on, because people were told that the OFWE was looking into alternative ways to organize this, but they were not told the full story, and they may have wondered about this.
And this may have also had an impact on the way leaders behave.
Okay. Other thing is that, you know, Veena Agarwal has been working on with forest user groups in India and Nepal, and she finds big gender effects. I mean, so in the refugee groups that have women,
yeah,
and also a critical mass, so not just three women in the out of 12, but a critical
right.
mass, then because women are more interested in making sure that the forest is used properly.
Right.
Either. So, I mean, obviously in this case, it could, but I'm just wondering whether, you know, gender might also play
right.
a role here.
I have nothing to say about that yet, but I did talk about it with Goitom last week as it happened, because I too saw that Journal of Development Economics paper, I think that you're referring to. So what they point to is they refer to this change in the law, right, in 2009 or 10, that says that we strongly recommend that 50% of the positions on the executive board should be women. And then they treat that almost as a sort of regression discontinuity approach, where they look at groups formed before and after, and they find these differences. Now, we don't have such an intervention. So we don't have any exogenous variation in the membership of the executive committee. Having said that, we know the gender of all the group members. And we also know the gender of the executive committee members. Now, the easiest thing to do, of course, would be to look at some simple correlations to find out whether we can find at least some very early evidence that suggests that gender also matters in this context. Now, we have not done that yet, but I talked about it with Goitom, and this is something we will try to do. It's also something that we might try to sneak into that follow-up study that I mentioned later. Because what we have here is essentially, we have a system of forest user groups in this particular forest area of Ethiopia, but beyond this area, there's much more forest that currently is not under forest user group systems. And OFWE also want to bring that under this participatory forest management scheme. And they're thinking about ways to somehow guide the process of drafting the bylaws, right? And they've asked Goitom to be involved in this and to also design this as an experiment. So the idea of somehow introducing the gender dimension into these new forest user groups, I think, is interesting. Especially because in that new study, we will be able to compare forest user groups to open access, right? This is all forest user groups A, B, C, D. There we will have forest user group A, B, C, and open access. And there, I think, hopefully, we will be able to turn to that. but our current data will only allow a very imperfect data.
Let me pop a question from the computer.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Ah,
yeah.
So, very interesting work.
But?
when it comes to the reward treatment, obviously getting fired compared to getting a solar panel, there's a big discrepancy.
Yeah.
Kind of the threat is quite big compared to the potential gain, so that could also reflect, as well as how well the village leaders sort of like, is it more like a lottery win, or like they trust really that this is such a great, like maybe a ray, or getting some sort of other recognition as well, or some, I don't know what would be a better kind of comparable treatment.
I should say, I think you're right first, but it went a bit beyond the solar panel, because in addition to the solar panel, all the forest user groups in this treatment arm were informed about the outcome. And there was indeed a ceremony where all 34 leaders were asked to come, and there the three people were asked to step forward, they got a certificate and they got the panel. So there was a little bit of that social recognition as well. But I think your other comment is spot on, in the sense that it's not so obvious to me even, let alone to them, what you should do in order to win the panel, right? Because a lot of different variables feed into this appreciation process, and I don't really know the production function, and I think nobody does, because at the bottom line, at the end of the line, there is some subjective weighing of different factors by the people in the OFWE. And I think that many leaders decided, well, we don't know what kind of game we are playing here, so we will not really change our behavior, right? So that is a little bit unfortunate, in the sense that these null results that we find here, it's not so obvious whether these are the result from the fact that the reward was in the past rather than the future, whether people are less responsive to rewards than to punishments, or because people did not know the production function. I mean, all those three explanations are equally valid to my mind, right? And I emphasized one here, but the other two, I think, are also plausible. In terms of scalability, I think the reward panel may be more difficult than the other ones, right? Mm-hmm. So in future research, this is the one that we will probably drop.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I said the solar panel cost $60, which is true, but in terms of purchasing power parity, it was $180-something, right? So it's really expensive, and if you have a large group of forest user groups, then in order for this incentive not to be diluted too much, I mean, you have to be handing out quite a few panels, and you have to keep on doing it, probably, right? So I don't know, I don't think the Ethiopian Forest and Wildlife Enterprise would be interested in scaling this up. I mean, it's nice to know that it doesn't work, at least the way we organized it now. It's not going to be a top priority in the future, I think.
So you were thinking of the mechanism, so why this has an impact then on the incomes and livelihoods. So could there be something that, since they were following the rules, the salaries got paid?
No. It's much simpler than that, and I should have said this.
Mm-hmm.
My main source is Goitom, and Goitom has been working with many of these groups. He also knows the people of the OFW. His story is much simpler than that. It's about theft.
Mm-hmm.
He says what happens in many of these groups is that outsiders approach the group leader for permission to take some trees here and there, and then pays under the table. Right? So to a large extent, the resource rents that are available to the group are being diverted by the leadership to outsiders, or they maybe do the harvesting themselves, and that is pocketed as private money for a handful of people. And if you stop that process, and then if you just take these revenues and you distribute those equally across the group members, then we would expect to find numbers of this magnitude, about $20 per group member per year. This is sort of what I... So it's not about salaries. Mm. It's not about anything like that. It's just about being able as an ordinary group member to share more equally from a larger pool of rents. Mm. That is my reading. Mm.
Thank you very much. I think we're out of time, unfortunately.
Yeah, normally I would say I'm around for questions, but that's not true. I'm going to run to my taxi. Okay, guys. Thanks.